Captain Casey, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Ready, Your Honor.
Lieutenant Commander Martin, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Captain Casey, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Erdman, members of the court. May it please the court, my name is Captain Jasper Casey, and I represent the appellant, Petty Officer Virginia Moritala. Chief Judge, I request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Petty Officer Moritala told the credit union that she was selling her car to Petty Officer Westerfield. And then she actually sold her car to Petty Officer Westerfield when she transferred title of the car in exchange for money right there at the credit union. Yet the military judge still convicted her of bank fraud. Now the problem in this case, and it's a problem that has persisted throughout the pendency of the case, is this confusion and conflation of two distinct concepts, ownership and possession. That's a mistake made by the appellant during her court-martial. It's a mistake made by the military judge. It's a mistake made by the government in their filings. And it's a mistake made by the lower court in its opinion affirming her conviction. Because what was actually presented was a real transaction, real money exchanged for a real car with a real transfer of title. So this court should find that Petty Officer Moritala's plea is improvident for two reasons. First, because the facts do present a substantial basis to question the province of her plea, and because the military judge was presented with a clear conflict on the record between my client's plea and the facts, and so the military judge had a duty to either resolve the conflict or reject the plea, and the military judge failed to do either.
Captain Casey, can I examine with you the actual wording of the specification? It wasn't just did knowingly execute a financial fraud on a financial institution. The actual language is, quote, did knowingly execute or attempt to execute a scheme to defraud a financial institution. So I'd like to explore both the words attempt and scheme here. Now, attempt, you know, we all know what that means in terms of looking at Article 80. You have to have a specific intent to commit the offense, and then you have to have committed a certain overt act that would tend to actually affect the commission of it. So with the facts here, even if, as you're stating, your position is that the signing over the registration and the title actually caused there to be the sale of the vehicle, why was there not an attempt to defraud the credit union here?
So, Your Honor, beyond my client's bare assertions that she committed bank fraud through an attempt to execute this scheme to defraud the credit union, there still has to be an alignment of the actual underlying mechanics of the transaction with the law. It's incumbent upon the military judge to ensure that not only does an accused have a clear understanding of the underlying factual basis for the crime, but the military judge needs to ensure that the accused understands the law and understands how the facts actually relate to the law. And what is apparent here, and it's throughout, contained throughout the record, that there's confusion on the part of Petty Officer Moritala as to what an actual fraudulent activity would be.
But, you know, when I look at some of the facts, she says here that the scheme was hers. She told Whiskey to lie to the credit union, that the intention was to use the loan proceeds for her business operations. She knew that they wouldn't receive a loan, either she would or Whiskey, or would not receive as favorable rates if they didn't lie to the credit union. And importantly, she says, well, by me keeping possession of the vehicle, if the Navy Federal Credit Union was looking for the vehicle, they wouldn't be able to repossess it. So why doesn't that spell out an attempt, even though she didn't actually manage to execute it properly?
Yes, Your Honor, it's not an actual attempt to commit bank fraud, because the statements that were made by Petty Officer Moritala and Whiskey Westerfield to the credit union were not actually fraudulent in any way. They did exactly what they were telling the credit union they were going to do.
Why is it not then at least a scheme? That's the other word that's in there. Scheme, we look at Black's Law Dictionary, talks about an artful plot or plan. And then when we look at Loughran versus United States, the Supreme Court says it doesn't matter if it was successful. It says we have long made clear that such a failure is irrelevant in bank fraud cases because what the section punishes is not completed frauds, but instead fraudulent schemes. Why is this not a scheme that she was entering into, even though, again, she didn't seem to understand from your viewpoint what would have affected the actual sale, the transfer of ownership of the vehicle to Whiskey?
Well, Your Honor, I agree that there was a plan between the two parties here, the two petty officers, but the only plan that apparently existed was a plan to conduct lawful sale of the vehicle, lawful activity. The fact that what's brought out...
Does it matter, though, that she did not know it was lawful? She thought, for instance, she said, and it's in the JA, that she said, let's lie, let's use the loan proceeds for the business, thought the credit union would not be able to repossess the vehicle because it would be with me. So why doesn't that matter, those facts that she admitted to?
So two things there, Your Honor. It's still our contention that there was nothing that was actually untruthful or fraudulent about what they were telling the credit union. And the fact that she thinks lawful activity is a crime is not dispositive. It was still incumbent upon the military judge to ensure that she had an accurate understanding of what constitutes bank fraud, what a crime is. And to be clear, even if the facts don't arise to my client's actual innocence, there's still the problem that persists if there is this clear contradiction that's presented to the military judge. On the one hand, my client is making bare assertions that she's guilty of bank fraud, over one dozen times as pointed out by the government. But on the other hand, the picture that's painted when she's actually describing the underlying mechanics of this purported scheme, it's just the lawful sale of her car. Real money exchanged for a real vehicle, a car she actually owned. She was allowed to sell it. The credit union gets a secured interest in the vehicle. They still can repossess had Westerfield neglected to make his payments. There's also this focus by Petty Officer Moratala on her ultimate intent for the money she receives from selling her vehicle. So if you look at Joint Appendix, page 86, paragraph 45, this is the stipulation of fact, she makes this odd assertion, I'll paraphrase, the registration and title are in Westerfield's name, but he did not have physical possession of the vehicle. The vehicle did not need to be paid off. I never intended to use this money to make any payments on the Kia Rio. I always intended to use this money for my house flipping business. That's irrelevant. She's allowed to bootstrap her own business by selling personal property, but she seems to indicate that she thinks that there's some sort of limitation on how she can use what has now become her property, her money. So that's one example of her indicating a clear misunderstanding of the law, and yet the military judge fails to ensure that she actually understands what constitutes bank fraud. And by the military judge's failure to clarify that inconsistency or reject the plea, that constitutes an abuse of discretion.
Counsel, can I ask a very specific question? The military judge asked her about 30 questions regarding this sale or purported sale of the vehicle. What specific question do you think the military judge should have asked to clarify the inconsistency?
I think there are a number of questions that should have been asked, Your Honor. For one, there is this focus by Petty Officer Moratala on her continued possession of the car. The military judge should have asked, was there an agreement between you and Westerfield? Why did you maintain possession? Why did you ultimately give the car to Petty Officer Westerfield? You know, what occurred there? Were there any separate agreements other than what was presented to the credit union? A number of questions that could have clarified this inconsistency on the record, yet we have this same mistake made over and over by the military judge and Petty Officer Moratala that's conflating ownership and possession. Her continued possession is not dispositive. What was legally significant was the actual transfer of title in exchange for money. At that very moment, right there in the credit union, Petty Officer Westerfield becomes the presumptive owner of the vehicle.
I suppose on that specific point, I mean, it sounded like in reading the transcript that she told the military judge, well, I retained possession of the vehicle. I eventually gave it to him. But suppose she had never actually given it to him and it was just, we executed this title switch, but I was going to keep the car, and we're going to invest this money, and we never, ever gave him the car later on. Would that be fraudulent? Or when you say presumptive, was there anything that needed to occur for this to be an actual sale? Because it kind of sounded like initially she wasn't going to give him the car, and then eventually she did, but she thought that the scheme had already been completed at that earlier time.
Well, Your Honor, I think what your question drives at is really the problem with this case, is that the military judge failed to ask those kinds of clarifying questions. Because the fact of the matter is, we did have, what ultimately took place was the actual transfer of the vehicle. And yet, here we are, October 2021, and we're still speculating about what the intent was behind the transfer of the title, at whether or not at any point her decision to transfer possession ever changed. And it's not the role of this court to speculate or the role of the parties. That was the job of the military judge to ask those specific clarifying questions to resolve this inconsistency. And the military judge failed to do that.
Let me ask also this question. You go into the bank, and the bank says, what's the purpose of this loan? And you tell them something that's false, intentionally lying. Now, ultimately, what you're doing is not improper, but you've told a lie. And I think she said, you know, about five times that she was lying about the purpose, and the bank had asked about this purpose. Is it enough that she lied about that, even if her underlying transaction was completely lawful, that she could have sold the car, could have used the money to invest in her business, but she told the bank officer, or intended to tell the bank officer, and agreed with the buyer to tell something false?
Your Honor, I don't believe that's enough, and her subjective bare assertions of guilt are insufficient here, because while she maintains over and over on the record that she was lying to the, that her and Westerfield were lying to the credit union, the facts on the ground tend to show a completely different picture. The fact that Westerfield was creditworthy in exchange for the money he receives title to the car, well, the credit union gets a secured interest in the car, those are all lawful transactions. So,
Casey, Judge Maggs's question raises another question, whether or not, if the bank knew what we all know now, would they have advanced the loan? And that may be something we cannot know, but isn't that the problem here, why we don't want people using less than accurate or less than forthcoming information, shall we say, to procure a loan?
Certainly I agree with Your Honor that we do not want people lying to financial institutions.
Doesn't the Marine Corps have an interest in that, or the Navy, or the Army, or Air Force?
I'd agree with that, Your Honor. My position here is, as the facts are actually adduced during the court-martial, doesn't appear there is any actual lie that was told to the credit union. Real money exchanged for a real car she was legally allowed to sell, title transferred, the bank has their secured interest.
But if you submit less than complete information, is that what we have here? We have less. She didn't tell us everything before she asked for the loan. She just told us some of what she needed. And the bank is saying, hey, wait a minute. If we'd known all that, we wouldn't have advanced the loan.
Your Honor, the information provided to the credit union, or I guess that's omitted, would still have to be material. There seems to be a focus during the province inquiry by Petty Officer Moratala on her later on intentions for this money, that is to invest in her house flipping business. But I don't think that would be material to the credit union. Their concern is getting secured interest in the collateral, in this case the car. What she ultimately does with her money, that's not material to the credit union. And I don't think that would have affected whether or not they extended this loan to Westerfield.
But, I mean, I don't really get what any of that matters. I mean, the statute makes it a crime to obtain the monies of a financial institution by means of false or fraudulent pretenses, representations, or promises. And the military judge asked her over and over and over again, did you make false representations? And she said, yes. He asked her five, six different ways. And she said, yes. So she obtained monies of a financial institution by false premises. How could we possibly say the military judge abused his discretion by taking her word for it? I mean, we're talking about speculation of like, well, I stole the candy bar, but then I was afraid I was going to get caught, so I returned it to the grocery store. I never meant to keep it. I mean, the question is, did you walk out of the store with the candy bar or not? Like, what difference does it make legally what she did with the possession of the car 3 months later?
If I understand your question correctly, Your Honor, I don't think it really is irrelevant that she maintained possession of the vehicle for some period of time. At that point, Petty Officer Westerfield owns the vehicle. He's allowed to loan it to a friend. He can park it. He can drive it on vacation. He's already the lawful owner of the car at that point. The problem here is when my clients, as you, Your Honor, pointed out, over and over on the record, makes these bare assertions of guilt that I was lying to the credit union, I'm guilty of bank fraud. But if you look at the lessons of U.S. v. Garcia, U.S. v. Prater, that's not the end of the inquiry for the military judge. This is the whole purpose of having the providence inquiry, to make sure that a accused subjective belief of their criminality actually aligns with the underlying facts. And here we have two very different things going on. We have bare assertions of guilt by my client, yet she can't describe why it was fraudulent without contradicting herself. The military judge failed to ask those clarifying questions, as Judge Maggs asked earlier. What specific questions would have clarified it?
This obviously is a failure to disclose pertinent facts rather than an outright lie. But doesn't the character of the individuals requesting the loan count when the bank or credit union does their evaluation? And here, if you look at the record, this is a less than creditworthy person who is juggling a lot of balls in the air, and it seems that she doesn't want them to know about that, that something that she may have to disclose if she requested the loan. They devised this scheme to get around it, but the bank knows nothing about the underlying character of the individuals involved. And that's all because of the failure to provide pertinent information.
Yes, Your Honor, my client is clear, and Chief Judge, I see I'm going to run short on time, 5 minutes.
Please answer Senior Judge Erdman's question.
Yes, it's clear that my client had concerns about her own creditworthiness, but when she's describing what this scheme purported to be, all it appears to be is her selling her own private property in order to raise capital to fund her business, which is a lawful activity.
That's separate from her intent in telling or not telling the bank something.
Yes, Your Honor. I agree. It's a separate activity. The issue that I see here is that the information that was supposedly omitted from the discussion with the credit union would not have been material to the credit union's decision whether or not to extend the loan to Westerfield. Their only concern is, does the seller actually have the legal authority to sell a car? In this case, yes. Have we determined that this borrower is creditworthy? Yes. Are we, the bank, the credit union, obtaining a secured interest in collateral? And the answer is yes.
You don't think that credit unions and banks require a little bit more than just the bare facts of a transaction, that there's going to be a collateral there? I mean, what if the person had a history of defrauding individuals?
That would certainly be material, I think, to the credit union's decision, but those aren't the facts that we have here, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor.
Lieutenant Commander Martin.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Erdman, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Commander Jeff Martin, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Chris Blosser, I represent the United States. This court should affirm because there is no substantial basis in law and fact to question appellant's guilty plea to bank fraud for two reasons. First, she admitted to executing a scheme to defraud AB&B Federal Credit Union, and second, she never intended to sell her car to BM2 Whiskey. To the first point, appellant concocted a scheme to gain money for her house flipping business. She tells the military judge that she was not qualified for a collateral loan on her own with the 2009 Kia, so she went to her friend BM2 Whiskey. The problem was that BM2 Whiskey had no collateral on his own, and he would be denied a business loan if he sought one himself. So she came up with this plan for him to lie to AB&B Federal Credit Union to say that he was actually purchasing her car. The problem was the intention was never to purchase the car. It was always to invest in the business. And to Judge Maggs' question, the scheme was complete when he filled out the application because Laughrin tells us that the bank fraud statute criminalizes fraudulent schemes, and that's what happened here. Now, to the materiality of the falsehood, of course, being the true purpose of the loan. Nader tells us that materiality is when the falsity would naturally induce a bank or is capable of inducing a bank of releasing the funds. And Laughrin specifically tells us this occurs most clearly where the accused makes a misrepresentation to the bank itself, which induces it to impart the money. And that's exactly what happened here. Appellant and DM2 Whiskey went down to AB&B Federal Credit Union. And the reason why that happened is because neither of them were qualified on their own. That's what makes this material. To Senior Judge Erdman's question, appellant was less than creditworthy. That's why she couldn't get the bank loan on her own. And, of course, to Judge Sparks' question, if the bank had known that, they wouldn't have advanced the loan. That's why the reason why she sought a collateral loan is because, in her words, it's easier and you get a lower interest rate. So if the bank had known the true purpose of the loan, they either would have refused to issue the loan or they would have given a higher interest rate. Either way, that falsity is material.
Counsel, I'd like to focus on your brief. It seems you put an awful lot of emphasis on the fact that the possession of the vehicle was not transferred for a couple of months. Why does that matter when the title was transferred? Why does it matter who was in possession of the vehicle?
Yes, Your Honor, and to my colleague's credit, he's correct that possession is not dispositive. Possession is indicative of intent here, and the government's position is appellant never intended to sell her car. This was not a valid transaction because there was never any mutual assent to the terms. In fact, appellant tells the military judge through her stipulation on a fact on Joint Appendix 86, I provided him, BM2 Whiskey, with the information on the car that he needed in order to secure the loan. So that tells us that this was not a valid transaction, but she needed to transfer the paperwork to convince the bank that this was a legitimate transaction and they would then turn over the funds. So the possession tells us to Judge Max's point that she was never going to turn over the car, and that's indicative of the fact that this was never a valid transaction.
But indeed she did turn over the car. So, again, in your brief you make it sound as if possession needs to be part of the sale of a vehicle. You're not saying that?
We're not saying that, Your Honor. Okay. No.
The other question I had is, sometimes in your brief it almost seems as if it was critical that the loan proceeds were going to the accused's business. Would it have mattered if she had put it into her bank account or used it for anything else for your purposes of saying that there was an attempt or a scheme here to defraud a financial institution?
Not at all, Your Honor. The only thing that matters is that the money wasn't used to sell the car as she and BM2 Whiskey fraudulently portrayed to the bank. She could have used it for anything else, and it still would have been a scheme at the time the money exchanged hands because the statute penalizes criminal schemes. In addition to Judge Maggs's point to my colleague about what questions should have been asked, the military judge did clarify, as this court has recognized, several times about the purpose of the loan, the purpose being investing in the business and not in in the true purpose of what they have portrayed as a car sale. She says flat out in Joint Appendix 55 that BM2 Whiskey would lie to the bank that it was to purchase the car, but it wasn't to purchase the car, it was to invest in the business. And to Judge Maggs's point, that lie is enough. So the possession point, to Chief Judge Olson, to your point here, again, it's not dispositive, but it's indicative that she never intended to sell the car. And I understand my colleague's position of her quote-unquote bare assertions of guilt, but as this court is well aware, there's a guilty plea case. And in a guilty plea case, Jordan tells us the facts are notoriously undeveloped. And that's why this is analyzed by the providence of the pleas and not the sufficiency of the evidence. There has to be more than a mere conflict here. So when appellant admits to the military judge that by keeping possession, that was contrary to the promises in the application, that's not the government's terms, as appellant seems to indicate. Those are her direct statements to the military judge. That shows that the bank thought that BM2 Whiskey was going to have possession of that car. And so if he defaults on the loan, they don't know where that car is, and so they can't go repossess it. So that's why appellant's cite to Hardiman to show inconsistencies in the plea on page 3 of his reply brief is inapt. Because in Hardiman, the problem in that case is that the military judge never elicited the starting date for the UA period, which this court said was a, quote, indispensable fact. Barton, in fact, is much more on point here. And in Barton, 44 MJ 496, which we cite on page 6 of our brief, that was where the appellant pled guilty to larceny of over $100 from the exchange in Okinawa. The problem in that case is that the appellant never actually stated on the record that he had intended to conspire to steal more than $100 worth of equipment. This court found no error, and this court found no substantial basis to question the plea there, because this court recognized that the element itself contained a specific factual threshold. And so the appellant was not actually admitting just to a bare legal conclusion, but in fact a combination of law and fact. And even in dissent in that, Senior Judge Sparks, Your Honor recognized, excuse me, Senior Judge Erdman, I apologize, Your Honor recognized that the problem in that case was that the military judge must elicit factual circumstances. And he did that here. As this court has recognized, in several different ways he asked her, what happened, what was the scheme, what was your understanding here? And each time she said, this was never about a car sale. The intention is not to purchase the car. In the stipulation of fact, the auto loan was not taken out for the purposes of purchasing the vehicle, but was instead used to invest in my house flipping business. And because that happened here, all the facts were elicited, they just all point to a scheme. The scheme that was complete by the time they left the bank. And because of that, that wasn't a sale. And therefore, the military judge did obtain the adequate factual basis to support the plea, and he didn't abuse his discretion. Now, assuming arguendo that this court disagrees and finds this a valid sale, then to Chief Judge Olson's point, this would be an attempt, because she met all of the requirements. She had the specific intent to defraud the bank, as she told the military judge many times over when she pled guilty to both clauses of 18 U.S.C. 1344, the first one, of course, being intent to defraud. She had a substantial step, and they had an overt act when they actually completed the scheme and went to the bank to do that. So even if this is not a completed bank fraud, it's an attempted bank fraud. Now, I do just want to touch briefly on the remedy if this court finds this is not an attempt as well, because the government disagrees with appellant on what the remedy is here. Appellant states that the remedy should be to dismiss the spec and remand for a rehearing on the sentence. That's not the appropriate remedy here for three reasons. First, Riley and Negron tell us that the appropriate remedy would be to remand on the merits, because that would put the appellant back in the position that she was before she entered the plea, and it would allow the United States to go forward on the charge and try and prove that up as well. Second, as appellant even admitted today, as well as in their brief, this would be a substantial basis in fact, not a substantial basis in law. Because it's a substantial basis in fact, that would allow a military judge to do a potentially more robust providence inquiry to answer questions that appellant has raised, potentially this court has raised as well, and save the specification. And then third, it would allow the convening authority the opportunity to withdraw from the pretrial agreement under RCM 705, because this court would have held the specification improvident upon appellate review. But pending any questions, I'll briefly conclude, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Captain Casey.
So, Your Honors, just to address a couple of points made by the government, there were a few times statements made such as Pastor Moratella never intended to sell her car. The money wasn't used to sell the car. But that's directly contradicted by the fact that she did, in fact, sell her car to Petty Officer Westerfield. The military judge, even during the province secret at one point, seemed to recognize that there might be a problem with the plea. Joint Appendix at 50, military judge questioned, did he actually purchase your car? And the response from my client, he didn't have possession of the car at the time that he handed me the money, Your Honor. Again, showing this mistake and this conflation of the two distinct legal concepts of ownership and possession. Pastor Moratella and the military judge both focused and honed in on the fact that she maintained possession of the car. But as stated earlier, and even as indicated by the questions from this court, her continued possession is really not relevant.
On that specific point, I mean, the government said possession is not necessary for a sale, the transfer of possession. But the government's argument was that the failure to transfer possession, either immediately or a short time afterwards, was an indicative that they didn't really intend a sale at the time they took the loan. In other words, it's not necessary, but it is evidence that, for example, if you're going to have a fraudulent scheme where you're going to pretend to sell a car, you wouldn't transfer possession, and it's indicative of that. Wouldn't that make it relevant?
Perhaps it could be indicative, Your Honor. But again, all we can do at this point is speculate as to why there was this delay in actual physical transfer of the vehicle. All we can do is speculate as to whether they had this separate agreement to have it be a sham title transfer. And it's not this court's duty to speculate. It's not the party's duty to speculate. This is indicative of why the military judge abused his discretion when he's presented with these clearly contradictory facts, bare assertions of guilt, colliding and contradicted by the underlying mechanics of what Petty Officer Mortal was describing.
Counsel, this sort of sounds like your position is this is something that you really couldn't have a guilty plea on because we'd have to talk to the bank officer and have the bank officer testify as to what information was relevant in making the loan. We would have to have maybe a look at the actual security agreement to say what see what the security agreement said with respect to who was going to be in possession of the car. And of course, none of that comes out in the guilty pleas. I mean, is it just the case that there are some crimes that you can't plead guilty to because there's no way that you can providently state the facts?
I would disagree with the statement that there are crimes you cannot plead guilty to. Our position here is that the facts actually don't indicate a crime. They indicate lawful private sale of an automobile. Thank you, Your Honors. I see my time has expired.
Thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks Captain Casey and Lieutenant Commander Martin. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 09:30.